The American dream is predicated on the idea of owning a home. Stability, success, a sense of belonging. It's the figurative and literal key to upward mobility and financial success. Most people design their lives around owning a home one day, and when it feels like you can't do that, it sucks. And so that's why it's really important to understand what's going on in the housing market that makes it impossible for people to own homes, and the policies that are being put forth in order to fix it. I had the chance to sit down with Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Wally Adeyemo, to talk about the policies that the government is putting forward to fix the housing crisis.
So one of the things that the president has us focused on is increasing the supply of housing, because that's one of the best ways to reduce the cost for all Americans is to have more supply.
Because the housing market has a lot of issues. It's policies and regulations, it's NIMBYism, it's demographics, it's economic factors, and the inherent speculative nature of home ownership. It's created this perfect storm that has led to the housing crisis. The lack of housing supply is a major driver of housing prices. We just don't have enough inventory for where people want to live. But we also have sky high mortgage rates because the Federal Reserve was raising rates in order to battle inflation. So if you're trying to buy a home right now, you're dealing with mortgage rates that are north of 6%, and they were like 2 to 3% a mere 3 years ago, and housing prices that have more than tripled since the early 1990s. Things have cooled off recently, but between December 2020 and December 2021, the median US home gained $52,000 in value, and in 11 markets specifically, it grew by over $100,000, which is basically impossible to keep up with. And even if you're not trying to buy a home, rental prices have skyrocketed too, moving at the fastest pace in 40 years. Between May 2021 and May 2022, rents went up by more than 15% to an average price of $2,000. There is a reason that housing drove two-thirds of the inflation metrics that we've had. And this is all problematic because housing is a foundational need. When people talk about how they experience the economy, that's usually what they're referring to. But there are also several lines of bifurcation. There are the 90% of homeowners that are locked in below 5% and into a fixed rate mortgage. They're pretty much insulated from monetary policy, and in my opinion, preventing us from having a recession, but also might feel like they don't have any mobility to move away. They might feel house rich, but cash poor. Then there are those who are dealing with the aforementioned mortgage rates, and they feel like they're not able to finance a home, and they have no mobility in general. Then there are those that swoop in with bathtubs full of cash, like the 70% of New York City homes that were bought with cash in the last quarter of 2023. And then there are the 40% of homeowners with no mortgage at all. About 32 million people, most of which are boomers. We all know this. We're kind of sick of hearing about it. So let's talk about the policies that are being put in place in order to fix it. Unfortunately, or fortunately, this is a problem that has to be solved at the policy level, something that happens at city, state, or federal. And luckily, there are many policies that are being put into place in order to fix this. So let's first talk about the initiatives that are around expanding home supply.
So one of the things that the president has us focused on is increasing the supply of housing, because that's one of the best ways to reduce the cost for all Americans is to have more supply. Ultimately, there is so much demand for housing in this country because since the financial crisis, basically, we've underinvested in building housing. And the pandemic only worsened that problem.
So yes, the pandemic did indeed worsen the housing crisis. There was a massive shift to remote work during the pandemic, and according to the San Francisco Federal Reserve, that accounted for more than half of overall house price growth during that time. But the pandemic only exacerbated the issues that we already had in the housing market. We have underbuilt since the Great Recession because a lot of home builders got scared. And so we've existed in this world where we don't have enough housing units for the number of people that want them, and now it's going to be about how do we reverse the years and years of underbuilding.
So at Treasury, one of the things that we have is the low income housing tax credit, which is one of the ways that we help to incentivize the creation of housing.
The low-income housing tax credit provides tax credits to developers for eligible projects to incentivize building affordable housing. It's the largest source of federal support for construction and rehabilitation of affordable renting housing across the country, building about 3.8 million units since 1986. The new income averaging rule allows flexibility around mixed income developments, which is important because we need all types of housing, something I'll talk about a little bit later.
And the president has proposed as part of his State of the Union address that we use the low-income housing tax credit to create 1.2 million additional units of housing all over the country that will help bring down the cost of housing, not just for the people who get those new units, but for everybody, because more housing in your community will mean that it'll meet the demand and hopefully decrease the cost for all of us.
Decrease the cost of housing for all of us sounds great, but this gets into the confusing part of the housing market. What is a house? What is it? Is it meant to be a speculative tool? Is it meant to be an investment? Is it meant to be something that we live in? What role does housing play in our lives? This series of tweets probably captures the confusion better than any paragraph I could write or say. So Elizabeth Warren tweeted, "America is in the middle of a full-blown housing crisis. There are a lot of ways to measure it, but I'll start with the most basic. We are 7 million units short of what we need to house people. What can we do? Increase the housing supply. It's plain old Econ 101. And somebody responded, "I'd like to buy a house, but houses are pretty expensive. At the same time, because houses are so expensive, I worry that something might happen to drop their price, making a house a bad investment. So I'd like to buy a house because it's a good investment, but I'm worried that the house price will drop, making a bad investment." As Derek Thompson wrote about this push and pull in his recent piece, in the US, our houses are meant to perform contrary roles in society, shelter for today, an investment vehicle for tomorrow. This approach creates a kind of temporal disjunction around the housing market, where what appears sensible for one generation, please no more construction near me, it's annoying and could hurt my property values, is calamitous for the next. Wait, there's nowhere near me for my children to live. And so that's the crux of the housing crisis. We have this inherent push and pull between housing being the wealth generation tool for the bottom 50%, getting into my favorite chart that shows the breakdown of wealth, and you can see that the bottom 50% have most of their wealth tied into their home, and then being something that we're meant to live in and build community around. Can you really make a ton of money off something that you're supposed to be housed in? Does it make sense? And so housing is the foundation for how we experience the economy. A lot of times the reason that people feel bad is because they're not able to get into homes that they would want to. And a lot of times people will block new housing because they want to preserve the value of their home. And that's NIMBYism, not in my backyard, avoid building around me, please. A lot of older homeowners will spend a lot of time blocking new development of housing for a variety of reasons. They're also staying in their homes a very long time, so we have this situation where new housing isn't being built and then new housing isn't coming on the market. Empty nest baby boomers own 28% of the nation's large homes, while millennials with kids own just 14%. 56% of homeowners age 60 plus said that they will never sell their home. And there are also immense tax breaks for seniors to stay in their homes, so it makes sense that this would be going on. There's also the lock-in effect, which is what Lance Lambert wrote about recently, where people are tied into this mortgage or they don't have one at all, so why would they move? And to be fair, the younger generation is buying homes. Roughly 1 in 4 Gen Zers are homeowners, with many buying during the pandemic, according to Redfin. But you also have an increasing number of the younger generation living at home, which this is a bifurcation issue. This is a wealth inequality problem. And there's still this older homeowner in their blueberries meme because of the intensity of the pushback sometimes to building new housing. And it's not just an age thing. Jerusalem Dimsis wrote about how the YIMBYs and climate change activists were butting heads in Minneapolis, with the climate activists freaking out about development because of the environmental cost. And the environmentalists are wrong about the environmental cost of building new housing. They're wrong about trees and open space and water quality. In fact, not building new housing can lead to sprawl and it can lead to more cars and vehicles and can actually be worse for the environment than not building at all. As Dimsis writes, about 425,000 people currently live in Minneapolis. Despite all this change, Butler's Wildflower Sanctuary remains a public park, quiet proof that growth and preservation don't have to be at odds. Even if triplexes replace single-family homes in nearby neighborhoods, from the sanctuary of the garden, no one would be able to tell. And that's the problem with NIMBYism, is that there's a rejection of change. But we need the change in order to make homes more affordable. And housing affordability is not just about building single-family homes, it is about building these triplexes and duplexes, because we need 1.86 million new homes per year into 2033 in order to keep up with demand. And this gets into the missing middle in housing, where we don't have enough townhomes, we don't have enough duplexes and triplexes, etc., and we could create millions of homes just by turning single-family homes into these. Building all types of homes is important because building is important. And this gets into the idea of filtering, that even building like luxury-style homes can help with the housing crisis. A rich person would move into the luxury housing, leaving another space open for a different person, that person would move into the previous space, and so on and so forth. Kate Pennington of UC Berkeley found that rents fall by 2% for parcels within 100 meters of new construction, and the risk of displacement is lowered too, improving overall neighborhood quality. Stephen Hoskins has put together a treasure trove of research papers that get into the value of building new homes, what it looks like to build new homes, the consequences of building new homes, and he cites two papers that talk about this idea of filtering, with one of the papers stating, building new homes, even expensive ones, leads to important trickle-down effects. Thus, stimulating the supply of new homes is a viable approach to improving the housing situation of the poor. A study by the Minneapolis Federal Reserve found the same thing. New units help keep current prices down for everyone by opening up new opportunities for low and moderate income renters over a few short years through a chain of residential moves. And so I'm saying all these things, so why can't we just build more homes? Zoning.
I think zoning is a nice way of putting it. I think one of the challenges we have is that many people don't want more housing in their community because they want to preserve the community the way that it looks at the moment. And part of our goal is to make the case to people that building more housing can be additive to the value of your community and improving it.
There are a lot of headwinds to building housing, and zoning is absolutely one of them. The Niece Cannon Center has put together a really brilliant paper talking about how we got here and how we've experienced housing crisis before and how we've gotten out of them previously. A lot of it is anti-density regulations as well as resistance to mass transit, because we did have a housing crisis in the 1880s, but that was mostly a population issue, not a political issue. We started building elevators and rail rapid transit, enabling people to live up or travel into cities. But then backlash began because people were like, I don't want all these big buildings around me. And they write, zoning emerged as the mechanism to control not only unwanted economic activity, for example, the defensible purpose of limiting areas in which industry could settle, but also unwanted neighbors. And so zoning has really choked out a lot of cities. Charlotte, North Carolina, 70% of that land is dedicated to building single family homes. In Los Angeles, 70% of that land is dedicated to building single family homes versus building more missing middle housing. And then within zoning as well, there's minimum lot sizes, height restrictions, parking requirements, even things like leaving space for our gigantic fire trucks to make turns, which is important, but the fire trucks are huge. And so there's all of these things that you have to keep in mind when you're building. And then the politics get messy too. Like the city of San Francisco recently voted to downzone, making it even harder to build homes in a city that has one of the worst housing crises in the country. And then you have cities that are upzoning as well. As Moltman and Ryan found in their working paper in 2024, upzoning can stimulate housing supply. If you make it easier to build homes, homes will be built.
I'll go back to my visit to Atlanta, where the mayor has been able to make the case to that city and to his constituents that making modest changes to the way that zoning has worked is going to improve not only the lives of people who get access to this new housing, but it's going to improve the economy for everyone in Atlanta. And I think that's true for communities all over the country.
And that's what we saw in Austin, Texas, a gem, surprisingly, for zoning reform. Because Austin, Texas is building enough housing, the rents there went down 7%. They upzoned 170 acres to allow buildings up to 350 to 420 feet, ended minimum parking requirements, eliminated single-family zoning, and allowed 3 homes on each residential lot, allowing for duplexes and triplexes, and allowed for tiny homes and accessory dwelling units. And this is what we could also see in Burlington, Vermont, as they just totally reformed their zoning, allowing for 2 buildings on every parcel and 4plexes everywhere. But zoning is still problematic in many places, and housing codes can also be a headache, specifying minimum off-street parking, minimum lot size, service coverage, mix of bedrooms, curb cuts, kitchen ventilation, which is great, right? Like, it's important to have some sort of framework in place, but it ends up preventing more growth than encouraging it. For example, according to Aaron Lubeck, a lot of suburban America is codified to all of these things: setbacks, sidewalks, planter strips, curb to curb, side setbacks, impervious surface max, density, 2 off-street parking spaces per unit, minimum lot width, and a minimum lot size. And the permitting process can be an absolute racket too. There was a developer in Boston who gave a $750,000 donation to a neighborhood association, presumably so they could go and build a new development in that neighborhood. The compounded effect of all of this, the housing codes, the restrictive zoning, and racketeering, ends up with cities that are not designed for people and ends up creating this shortage of housing, because you can build, but it's hard. As Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Adeyemo says,
and in order to do that, what the administration has done is we've put together grants for local communities that are willing to take on some of those interests and to advance building more housing in communities and changing the rules to make that possible. Ultimately, the way we're going to solve this problem is we're going to have to do it community by community, which is hard, but we think that the thing we can do in the federal government is create financial incentives that help communities that are trying to do the right thing pay for that going forward. And we've seen success.
It has to be community by community, and a lot of local communities are taking this on. Montgomery County, Maryland is a great example of this because they just decided to start bidding on projects because developers require a 20% profit, but the government doesn't. And so they stepped in and they said, you know, these projects aren't being produced at a loss. They are generating money, but they're not generating 20%. So they've built a 268-unit mixed-income, mixed-use construction project that is financed through a $100 million fund created by the county government. The fund does partner with private developers, offering them large discounts, which most developers are pretty happy about. That is now this huge complex is being followed by a 463-unit complex for seniors and families and a 415-unit complex across the street. Because if you give people money and a way to build, they're going to do it.
Most of the money that the federal government gets, we provide to states and local governments that then spend it on things like affordable housing. For example, as part of the American Rescue Plan, we gave state and local governments more than $350 billion. Just last week, I put out a blog that gave those state and local governments more flexibility to use any of that remaining money to do exactly what you said, come in and provide resources to either complete housing projects or build new housing projects in order to make sure that we're meeting demands in their communities.
There are also things like the Innovation Fund for Housing Expansion, which is a $20 billion competitive grant fund that would support the construction of affordable multifamily rental units, incentivize local actions to remove unnecessary barriers to housing development, pilot innovative models to increase the production of affordable and workforce rental housing, and spur the construction of new starter homes for middle-class families. There are also initiatives like converting commercial properties into residential properties. $35 billion has been dedicated towards that. None of it has been used yet because the stipulations are quite intense, the environmental review, the permitting processes, everything that we just talked about. And commercial to residential is harder, but it is starting to happen.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a few months ago, I was in Atlanta and I had a chance to go with the mayor to a project that they are doing to create affordable housing using a commercial real estate property. And I know in places like Cleveland, they're doing the same thing. And while they may not be using the $35 billion that have been set aside as part of the infrastructure package, they are using federal money. They're using American Rescue Plan money to build some of this housing. So from our standpoint, what we want to do is create enough flexibility with all of the federal resources so cities and states can use them to build affordable housing in any way that they want.
And it is possible, according to Commercial Observer. Construction costs for a ground-up residential development in Manhattan could run $500 to $600 a square foot, while a conversion generally costs between $300 and $400 per square foot. So it is cheaper to convert commercial to residential rather than build an entirely new residential.
But as I've looked into it, because I agree with you that ultimately, where possible, converting commercial real estate into residential housing makes a lot of sense. They're like practical issues. Some of them being that there's just not enough bathrooms in a commercial real estate build to turn it into apartment buildings. But then there are local political issues where many of these local communities would rather try and hold on to commercial real estate because of the tax revenues than turn it into housing. But ultimately, I think mayors like the mayor in Atlanta and leaders all over the country know that one of the biggest challenges we face today is that housing costs too much. And the only way that we're going to address this challenge is by building more housing and helping people get into housing that is affordable for them over the long term.
The incentives just have to be in place. And commercial real estate is a problem within itself, but it gets into the value that businesses get from building more housing, because this is not just an individual issue. It's not just that people can't go and live the American dream. It's that businesses can't find people to work for them.
One part of my job is talking to CEOs and small business and large business leaders. And what they tell me is that it's hard for them to find employees. And when they find employees, it's hard for those employees to afford housing near the places where they want them to work. So housing isn't only a challenge for individuals, it's a challenge for businesses in our country too. Mm-hmm. So building housing is going to contribute positively to the economy locally, but also nationally for us as well. That's why I think if you talk to a business owner, the things that they're often talking about is workforce training and more workforce housing, so that we have housing for the employees that work at their factories and work at their companies that is affordable for them.
And this impacts the entire economy.
And I think that the thing we have to think about, and you said this already, housing is at a core critical to the economy, but also critical to our communities. And the idea that people have had to live further away and commute further to come to work has huge costs for not only our climate, but for our communities, because that hour and a half drive that could be a 15 to 20 minute commute is the difference between being able to coach Little League and instead sitting in the car, just from the standpoint of community impact. But it also comes at huge cost to our infrastructure in our country. And that's partially why we're very focused on trying to build more housing, multifamily, but also single family, that is close to transportation hubs. So subways and bus lines, in order to reduce the impact on the planet of the fact that right now, for too many Americans, they're not able to afford to live near their place of work. So building more housing, building housing that's close to opportunity, is going to have a critically important impact, not just on the individual who gets that housing, but on the economy, and also on our ability to meet some of our goals when it comes to things like climate change.
That is an extreme cost of infrastructure per square foot, something that Governor Doug Burgum highlighted in a recent talk.
Zoning came during the Industrial Revolution, when there was a lot of like air pollution, other things. Say, hey, we're going to have the factories here and the people here, and we got to keep them separate. And then we went even further and said, well, here's the kind of homes that can be and retails there. And we just, you know, it was a one-dimensional map, and you draw it out and say, everyone, all these four things have got to be separate. And yes, that was great for it. That was great for people that built roads, and it was great for the car companies. And then we built a city that's designed, we built cities all over America that are designed for automobiles and not designed for people. And then if you take a look at your cost, anybody that's been a mayor like Spencer's been, the cost of running a city is the linear feet of everything. It's the linear feet of sewer and water and sidewalk and roads. And then when you get more of that, you need to have more fire stations, low income. If you have a neighborhood that's all houses, if you want to have a coffee shop that looks like a house, you should be able to have a coffee shop. Because then people say, I leave my starter home, I've got to move to a new home, it's got to have three-car garage. Why does it have a three-car garage? Because the mom, the dad, and the kids all got a car to be able to drive to school, drive to church, drive to a restaurant, drive to a grocery store. Of course you need all that, because you can't walk to anything. And part of, then people will, you know, they'll go on a vacation and they'll say, wow, that was the most amazing vacation I ever had. Why? Well, because we went to some place where we could walk and everything was right there. Well, you can actually have that in our own states. You just have to design it. We haven't sent, you know, there's places in Northern Europe that have snow where people bike all winter long. You can't find a place like that in the U.S. because we don't put the investment into building the infrastructure for multimodal transportation. So I think one of the things that we have to look at as a country, our housing costs are high, in part because of the way that we've designed our cities. And I think there's, this form, check out form-based code. There's some really interesting things that are there. And you guys talked about the beginning, the granny flats and other stuff. But part of it is we've got to get the coffee shop, the barber shop, and law firms back into residential neighborhoods in ways that can help lower the cost and create services where you don't need a car for everything.
We have to redesign our cities. We have to build more housing. We have to think about how the cities are being developed. And then, of course, there's the jobs component, too.
I think one of the things that we've done is we've seen a huge influx in workforce training programs that have been funded by the American Rescue Plan. Traditionally, I think the federal government spends maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion on an annual basis on workforce training. Because of the American Rescue Plan, over the course of the last 3 years, we spent $12.8 billion on workforce training to help people get the skills they need to do the jobs that are in need in the economy. I visited a location a few months ago in California, where they were training people to become welders, which is a profession that's needed for so much of the construction trade. These were Americans who had fallen through hard times, maybe spent a little time in prison or had lost a job. They couldn't train them fast enough to go from being the training program to getting an entry-level job that paid them $60,000. I visited another workforce training program in Atlanta where they're also going to train people to go into these construction trades. And the key is that for many of these trades, one of the things that is best for these people who do these jobs is that you start at an entry level. Some of them include apprenticeships that will allow you to earn up to six figures in these jobs. So the key for us is making sure that we invest in the training so that we have the employees to not only build housing, but to build all the things that the economy needs. And because of the money that has been invested in workforce training by communities, but also by the federal government, I think we're better positioned to do that. But ultimately, finding more people to do these jobs is going to be a critical path, a critical thing that we have to do to be able to succeed at building more housing.
There are many policies being put into place to fix the housing crisis, and it's not just subsidizing demand, but it is expanding supply. But we have all these variables: status anxiety, the dual role of housing, housing as a retirement account, wealth inequality, the constraints on economic growth and labor mobility, longer commute times, and sprawl, and lack of innovation. In Negative Yield New York, Alex Yablon wrote of the importance of cities being accessible to those just starting out, and how policies like what we just talked about could fix it. He writes, "But once the city gets access to extremely low interest credit, it could also invest in massive amounts of new housing to drive down the cost of living as well as cultural infrastructure. The city could create new studios, rehearsal spaces, galleries, and performance venues to ensure that its vital artistic economy can thrive alongside our other sectors that have increasingly crowded out the underground." And there was another quote that talks about how when people don't feel free, that is constraining, obviously. "There's a deep sense in which freedom is achieved through the basics of life being extremely plentiful and cheap. When we don't further that, people's lives become less free. When you feel like you don't have the mobility to go and get a start in a big city, or you're too economically constrained in order to take a risk on yourself, that impacts the entire economy. The downstream effects of not having enough homes and not enough cheap homes for people has really impacted innovation. It's the housing theory of everything. Lowering housing costs creates so many downstream benefits and frees up so much capital." There was a Bloomberg piece that had a killer paragraph that said, "Instead of driving more innovation and growth, the bounty from today's knowledge economy is instead diverted into rising land costs, real estate prices, and housing values. The result is that working and middle-class Americans are forced to devote ever larger shares of their hard-earned money for shelter. The central contradiction of capitalism today is that a huge share of its productive surplus ends up being plowed back into dirt." Oh my gosh. But you know, a lot of people talk about it's time to build with regards to startups. They're like, go build, go do this thing. But the thing is, you can think of it like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? The triangle. If we're not addressing the foundation of how people experience the economy, it's going to be difficult for them to go and take a big risk on themselves. And so then you have sort of this selection bias where the only people that are taking risks are those that have been able to have that risk financed, whether that be through parents or maybe they figured it out, right? But having the ability for more people to take on more risk in terms of how they direct their lives, not in the stock market, but in terms of how they direct their lives, is incredibly important. Having some sort of fail-safe measure in place for them through maybe cheap housing is important too. Allowing more housing would ultimately allow more people to build. It would remove probably elements of our structural and social isolation. It would help to rebuild trust in institutions. Right now, a lot of people feel misled because the American dream has evaporated. And so the faster that we can address housing, as we're doing through these policies, we can connect with each other and maybe have hope in the American dream again. And finally, direct file is another policy tool that will help innovate in the tax space specifically, removing middlemen.
Direct file is a new tool that the IRS has created that's going to help Americans, and for now it's going to be a pilot, but help Americans who are earning an income through a W-2, get a paycheck, middle-class, working-class Americans file their taxes more easily. And it's going to make it faster for them to file their taxes, but it's also going to be free. And that's different than what is the normal experience of most Americans. The average cost for an American to file their taxes using a preparer service is $240, and it takes them 13 hours to do. The last time the IRS got money to invest in technology, it was the 1960s. Before we had the ATM, before a man went to the moon, before we had the personal computer, was when they built their infrastructure. They are still coding in a language called COBOL at the IRS. So what's happened is that Congress, as part of the Inflation Reduction Act, gave the IRS money. And what they're doing with that money is they're using it to make it easier for the American people to interact with the IRS. And one of the things that we've done is create direct file. And the way it makes it easy is because the IRS is the agency that deals with the tax code, they're able to create a product that both allows you to get intuitive answers to your questions, but also has a calculator that will help you as you're filling out your taxes, make sure that you're getting the credits that you're eligible for. So if you're a firefighter and you're filing out your taxes, it'll make sure that if you have children, you make sure you're claiming the child tax credit so that you get the incentives and the money that you deserve from the federal government as you're filing your taxes and you get the right return. The thing that you have is you have a choice, and you can make the choice of paying money to one of the online providers and taking the time it takes to use them, or you can use a free product that's given to you by the government that will allow you to help calculate your taxes and hopefully will go faster. It's ultimately a choice you have to make. And I think each American will have to make a choice that's right for them. But our hope is that for a middle-class family, they're going to make the choice that means they have to pay no money and they have to spend less time so they can invest that money and time in their families.
Policy innovation is everywhere, and it is indeed time to build.
Because we know that's one of the most important issues, no matter your age, no matter where you live in the country, is the cost of housing is something that is higher than we want it to be, and we want to do everything we can to bring it down.